everybody. Welcome back to the show. Science, Facts, and Fallacies, episode 259. My name is Cameron English. That lovely lady over there, Dr. Liza Dunn.
Hi.
ER physician, toxicologist, person here to answer all the technical questions. It's awesome. Great to see you. How you doing, Liza?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I am wonderful. Thank you for asking. Just living the dad life. Doing yard work with my kid.
Yeah, I'm going to the mom prom today.
Yeah, that's a new thing to me. What is a mom prom exactly?
It's a senior mom prom. My son goes to an all-boys school, and they have a prom for the moms, which is wonderful. I'm very excited. It'll be fun.
Awesome.
We'll do the box step.
Yeah. Could just imagine you like getting down to Taylor Swift or something.
I know, right?
All right. So. Well, with that image in your head, everybody, let's talk about some science. We've got three cool stories. We always do, but I think in particular one of these is especially awesome. So first up, with just a sample of fluid surrounding a baby in the womb, researchers can make mini organs to test out potential medical treatments. Next up, after two decades of GMOs, scientists find they live up to their promise. And finally, parents' Bill of Rights. Vaccine wars heat up in states allowing exemptions for school children. All right, very controversial, that last one. Nevertheless, I think these first two stories are pretty cool. And let's actually focus on the GM one first, Liza, because sure. This is not a new story. Every once in a while, GOP will run like a greatest hits kind of an article, and this is one of those. This is from 2018. There was a major analysis that came out that year looking at the effects of genetically engineered corn, like the first generation of insect-tolerant, herbicide-resistant corn. And they're looking at what was the impact on yields, what was the impact on public health, so on and so forth. And to spoil the story for everyone, if you're a listener to the show, it's not new information to you. Nothing happened. Not even a stomach ache. No public health concerns. More food. Lower food prices.
Everybody loved it.
Wealthier farmers. It was good. Yeah. It was good all around. So basically, all of the scandal and all of the scaremongering, nothing came to fruition. And there's some specifics. I'm sure you can get into those if you like, Liza. But I just wanted to bring this up. Every once in a while, I like to poke my finger in the eye of the anti-GMO people and just go, you're wrong. You know, all this shaming, all the people's careers you tried to destroy, all the people that Liza and I work with, didn't work.
That's exactly
so. And I should mention, this is from Futurism. The story's by Chelsea Goad. If I'm saying that correctly, go check out this article and then go read the study itself. It's not too technical, but what did you think about this, Liza?
Yeah, I think this is a wonderful study. It's a meta-analysis they've compiled lots of different studies together and looked at the statistics across the board and found that GM technology has been really, really revolutionary and wonderful. It's got a great environmental profile in that you actually decrease the use of pesticides with this technology. And depending on the pesticide, it's anywhere from 11%. I think I saw 11% for decrease for herbicide use and up to 45% decrease for insecticide use. I think that's the correct number. There was also a marked increase in yield. And this is just corn that they were looking at, but marked increase in yield from anywhere from almost 6% to 24% increase in yield. So that means you need less land to produce more food, which means that you have a lower environmental footprint. The thing that I find most attractive about biotechnology and GMOs in general is that the technology decreases the incidence of contamination with mycotoxins. So what's that? Why is that a big deal? So insects carry fungal spores from weeds into crops, and they like to munch on these crops. And while they do it, they deposit the fungal spores on the crop. And then the fungi multiply and they elaborate mycotoxins. And mycotoxins in trace amounts can cause pretty significant problems for human health, human and livestock. One of the big ones that you worry about is you worry about aflatoxin. And aflatoxin, aflatoxicosis can cause acute liver failure. So people will die of, you know, vomiting blood, essentially. And so they're, when their livers fail, you can't clot your blood. And it's a really, really miserable death. And so they'll have jaundice and a whole bunch of things. And there currently in South Africa and in Namibia is an aflatoxin outbreak. If the biotechnology that's used to prevent the insects from feeding on the crop. So the way it works is you've got a totally natural chemical made by a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis that only targets very specific crop pests. We've discovered the gene that makes that, makes the protein that does that for the insects that feed on crops, and we've put it in the crops. So therefore, you don't need insecticide, or often very little bit insecticide, and you also then don't get this fungal contamination of these crops. And it turns out that there's a what we call a halo effect. A lot of times, farmers who will produce, you know, GM technology, they'll put that right next to their conventional or their organic fields because the insecticidal properties of this crop actually helps protect the other crops, be they conventional or organic. So it's got a halo effect. So it improves the environmental footprint. It improves food security. If you are able to have more productive yields, farmers can make more money. So economically, farmers have more money. And if they're a smaller farmer, their kids can go to school. You know what I mean? If you're a subsistence farmer, that's a huge, huge thing to have more money. So my contention is that this is really revolutionary technology that has that is the cornerstone for global food security, and I think that the Global South should have access to the same tools that has brought so much prosperity and abundance to the Global North.
Enormously important. It's really easy to oppose this when you're full and you're not sick, when your liver's functioning, when you don't have cancer, when you don't have to worry if the food that you buy is potentially fatal, you know?
Yeah.
That's a big deal. The other aspect of this on the environmental side that's really amusing to me, there's a bit of irony here, is that a lot of the people who are self-identified climate activists, in quotes, you know, they oppose this technology, which significantly lowers the use of fossil fuels and significantly reduces erosion.
Yes.
So this is a boon to the environment. And because you have to use less active ingredient in the chemistries that we use for weed control and insect control and so forth, there's less fossil fuel use from that as well. Like this, this is enormously beneficial from an environmental perspective. And I think that just blows up people's brains. They're just not prepared for that. So I haven't had this experience yet, but if anyone stops me on the road with their hands glued to the pavement and they're going to protest the climate, I'm just, instead of fighting them, which is my inclination, is get out of my way. I have things to do. I'll explain this, you know, I'll like start a conversation and film it.
While you're stuck.
Yes. Like, hey, fellas.
I've got a story to tell
you. I'm not going to cut your hands off the pavement. I mean, if you want to glue them to the street, then you're kind of stupid, whatever. But I'm going to do that and see like what, like their brains.
I'm going to sit right down, crisscross applesauce.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll have a little conversation.
Yeah. Let's break bread and eat. Yeah. But all that to say, this technology is important, and there's a reason why farmers, by and large, picked it up. You know, like Monsanto could not have sold this, and Syngenta and all the big ag bad guys, all the naughties, they could not have made money if this wasn't effective.
That's exactly right. And, you know, a lot of these traits that we use are, you know, inexpensive for people. It's not like they're extraordinarily expensive, and the return on that investment is so marked that farmers really want access to that technology.
Yep. So I just wanted to bring that up. Think of it as a, now that's what I call science volume 14, you know, like those CDs they used to sell with all of the top 40 songs. That's what the story is to us as we talk about this. Just wanted to bring it up.
And it's actually probably important to look at it again in light of the American Academy of Pediatrics discussion saying that GMOs are somehow unhealthy. That's just not based on science. And here's the science that defends that.
Yeah. By the way, we need to come up with a new name for them. The best I've come up with so far is the American Clown College of Pediatrics. Maybe there's something zippier. Everyone listening, work on this. We need to get this out into the ether, into the atmosphere. Because we're going to talk about AAP a little bit in just a few minutes. But this is great news. If you want to follow the science, here's the science you need to follow, everyone out there who's skeptical of GMOs. Okay, let's move on here. This is my favorite story of the day, Eliza, and I want you to explain all the science in here. But this is originally from the Associated Press. This is by Laura Unger, and original story is called Scientists Have Used Cells from Fluid Drawn During Pregnancy to Grow Mini Lungs and Other Organs. So the gist here is that during a pregnancy, and Liza, correct me if I'm wrong, but these cells are shed, they're stem cells that are shed in the amniotic fluid. And so during routine testing, doctors can collect these and then you can basically grow mini organs.
Yep.
And you can, and interestingly enough, I think they're specific to the individual child. So if there's a potential problem that you're anticipating for this pregnancy, you can monitor it, I guess, more closely and potentially come up with a treatment because of this technology. So break this all down for us.
Yeah. So there are a lot of different cool avenues you can go down with this article. So this is, a lot of times when women are pregnant and they're concerned about a potential fetal anomaly, they'll do what they call an amniocentesis, where they'll take amniotic fluid, they'll stick a needle into the uterus and take out an amniotic fluid and sample it to see if there, and look at cells in there to see if there are any, there's any indication of some kind of anomaly. So you can find things early in those, in a lot of cases. And if you can find things early in a lot of cases, some of those things are actually fixable. So the things one of the coolest pictures I've ever seen is of a surgeon repairing a meningomyelocele, which is a bulging of the spinal fluid out of the back. The spinal column doesn't close all the way. And if you're born with this, you can wind up with lower extremity paralysis, incontinence, all sorts of, it's a very devastating problem. And it's thought to be due to maternal, not taking enough folate. So anyway, but long and short is if you catch this in utero, you can actually repair it. And one of the coolest things I've seen is a surgeon doing this operation on a baby in utero, and the baby's hand is reaching out and holding onto the surgeon's finger. It's a beautiful photograph. And so anyway, long and short is you can get cells out of amniotic fluid and make organoids. And if there is a indication that there is an anomaly there, you can see that pattern in the cells. And the other things, that's kind of interesting in and of itself, but there are a lot of other things that are very cool about this. So one of the things that people worry about is that often there, when you're testing a pharmaceutical or you're testing a chemical and you want to know if it's got side effects, you do animal testing. And the reason why you do animal testing is because you've got a whole system in place, right? So if you feed an animal a pill, that will go through the digestive tract, then get absorbed into the, you know, bloodstream, and then get delivered to the tissue of interest. So that's a whole system. That's needed at the moment, because when you do tests on cells in petri dishes, so in vitro tests, those cells are, they may be from an organ system, but they're, or a tissue, but they're naked cells with none of the other parts that connect the rest of it, right? So one of the things that they've been trying to do is figure out novel alternative methods for testing and to get away from animal testing. And this kind of technology would be able to create organoids where you'd be able to do real-time testing on a tissue or an actual mini organ rather than pouring a chemical on a cell in a dish, which doesn't have any of the protective features that organoids do. So I think that's a really promising avenue from that kind of thing. Right now they've got something called organ on a chip, where they've got little tissues that have a 3D microfluidic cell culture and then a circuit that keeps the organoid perfused. And then you can do systems testing for pharmaceutical companies or anybody who's using a chemical that people will be exposed to. These can also be used as models for disease, right? So let's say you've got a mutation that you causes, let's say, cystic fibrosis, and a mutation that doesn't. You can actually use CRISPR-Cas9 to either induce that mutation and then see how the cells respond to different treatments. And in fact, some people who have had resistant cystic fibrosis or very hard to treat cystic fibrosis have actually benefited from this by getting a, because they've been able to use this testing to try to find a treatment that helps them. So it's very different kinds of things like that. And then eventually there's one case report that I've seen where they may actually be able to use this kind of thing for transplants. So there's a case report, I want to say out of Japan, where they got somebody who, let me backtrack a little bit. A lot of these treatments have used pluripotent stem cells, and they've tried to use embryonic stem cells and things like that. And this, you can get those cells without having to get an embryo involved in all of the red tape and all of the ethical concerns about that kind of technology. So I think this has potential to bypass that in an ethical way and use these particular cells. But in terms of transplant, they had a patient who had ulcerative colitis in Japan, and they were able to take some tissue and they were able to grow a little organoid and then transplant those into the tissue, the affected tissue, and it's a patient's own. So you don't have the question of rejection and things like that. So I don't know if that was clear. It's just very exciting. And there are multiple things you could do with this that I think are really neat.
Yeah, it's incredible. And on the ethical side of things, it's really important, and this will tie into our last story as well, is that, you know, there's a lot of conversation today around how do you get people who may be inherently skeptical of science to embrace science? And one of the well-established ideas is that you appeal to their values, or at least you don't offend them. You try to end run what they're worried about and show them, just like with the climate thing and pesticides, right? They're worried about climate change. You go, hey, funny you should mention, here's this awesome technology, right? It's the same thing here, because you have a lot of conservatives around the country. Abortion is a key issue to them.
Yep.
IVF is a key issue. All of these technologies that are either in use already or are being developed, this freaks a lot of people out. So if you can present something like this and say, as one of the bioethicists quoted in the story points out, this doesn't harm the developing child. This doesn't harm the mother. So the pregnancy is going to continue. And in fact, this could help that specific child.
That's exactly right.
You know what I mean?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So add anything you like. But I think that's an important aspect of this.
It's a totally important aspect of it, too. And one of the scientific things about embryonic stem cell being used for Parkinson's or for spinal cord injuries and things like that, that never gets discussed. That's a scientific issue that has turned out to be part of the reason why over the past 20 years, even though there's been a whole lot of discussion about embryonic stem cell work, that there hasn't actually been a actual therapy that's made it to the market in 20 years, is because when you take rapidly dividing immature cells and you don't know how to turn them off, you've got the potential for making a tumor. And if you've got a brain tumor, if you've got a tumor in a closed box to your skull, and you don't know how to turn it off, that can be a problem. So it's not just what concerns me once again, and we did a space on last Friday. So if you guys want to check it out, listen, because we talked about a little bit about why there's not trust in science. And one of the reasons we came to the conclusion is that there are not enough dissenting voices that are given a platform. Now, we're not saying that you have to, you know, platform somebody who's crazy and hostile and things like that. But if there is a legitimate scientific question, you should be able to entertain that question. And so, because the goal of science is to get to the truth, it's not to decide, you know, a political party or whatever is popular, right? Otherwise, we'd be having lobotomies now, right? If, you know, 50 years later, or 70 years later, if there was no discussion, open discussion. And that's what the way the scientific method should be. That's the way science should be pursued in order to find the truth. And so there's no discussion about the possible side effects of implanting embryonic stem cells into people's brains. And in fact, the New England Journal of Medicine relatively recently, a couple years ago, reported a case where a man had gone to Mexico for a stem cell injection in the cord, and then wound up with a big tumor on his spinal cord and worsening symptoms. So that side of the discussion was never entertained, and anybody who raised that issue was automatically put into, you know, a far right wing category. And I think that that's unfortunate, because remember, the principle is first do no harm. And that's why I think this is such a cool article, because this actually has the potential to do things for people and scientists, and it just really in a way that's ethical.
I want to read a quote here as we go into this last story, because it speaks to what you're talking about. This is, we're going to play Guess the Quote, everyone. So let me read this first. So this person says, I think we should always be able to question the science behind public health recommendations, and this questioning should occur in the open so that the public and the press can best understand the strengths and weaknesses behind specific recommendations. Every recommendation has strengths and weaknesses. If we fear public debate, then in the context of this quote I'm reading, the anti-vaccine activists really have won. Now, I'm going to spoil it. Think about who might have said that, but I'm going to spoil it here in just a second. That wasn't Vivek Ramaswamy. That wasn't Ron DeSantis. That wasn't Ladapo, the Surgeon General in Florida. That was Dr. Paul Offit, who is one of the leading authorities on not only vaccine safety, but science communication. And He's not a weirdo. He's not on the right wing. He's right. As far as medical authorities go, he's one of the people that everyone looks to and goes, oh yeah, this guy's legit, except for the goofy anti-vaccine people that stalk him at work and stuff. They're the only ones that don't like him. So all that to say,
and he'll even talk to them.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Cordially.
He will. And he talks all about in all of his writing about, you know, sitting down one-on-one with people and listening to them and how that is effective. But nevertheless, I think that point that he's making, it illustrates how you address a situation like this is, you don't go, oh, you must be stupid and uber religious and racist, and that's why you don't like science. There, I solved it, everyone, right? That's not the answer. So with all of this in the background, let's go on to this last story. This is originally published by Nature. This is by a journalist named Amy Maxman. It's called Parents' Bill of Rights, Vaccine Wars Heat Up in States Allowing Exemptions for School Children. So she's talking here about a handful of, I guess they're mostly conservative states here in America that are introducing bills, or they've already passed them into law, that allow, or rather they require the birth parents of a child to sign off on a vaccine or another medical treatment. And this is having some unintended consequences as far as the scientific community is concerned, because you have situations, just as an example, where you have an adopted child who is, you know, taken out of their original home, from their birth parents for whatever reason, and their adopted parents can't get them vaccinated because of these laws. And so this is freaking a lot of people out. And so the story is all about trying to get down to the bottom of what's causing this. And Maxman goes into a few things. She talks about misinformation on social media. She talks about this sort of fusion that has occurred between the parents' rights movement and the anti-vaccine movement. She says the parents' rights movement it's largely a right-wing phenomenon. You have these parents who want to be involved in decisions around their kids, those crazy people. And and they're starting to see overlapping issues, and they're joining forces on that. And so she goes on to say, we need to do something to get this in line, because the risk is we're not going to get kids vaccinated against diseases that are preventable. Measles is the most recent one she talks about in the story. Liza, I've seen you talking about that on social media, that you have cases of measles. I mean, we have a vaccine that prevents this for life. And it was near eradicated by the year 2000 in the United States. And it's starting to make a comeback. And Maxman and other people in the science community see these kinds of laws as a serious threat. And it seems from the story, this is mostly, she sees this as a conservative political problem. It's a matter of getting these people away from their vaccine skepticism. And that's how we're going to eliminate bills like this. So what did you think?
My contention is that we need to be reflecting on how we communicated things as physicians, how we communicated things, and why all of a sudden there's something that we didn't do right. And because if we had done it right, then nobody would have questions about vaccines, right? This is not an exclusively conservative thing. This thing started out, there are people in, you know, Beverly Hills 90210 that have lower vaccination rates than some parts in sub-Saharan Africa. And so this is a bipartisan issue. And I think that is not adequately recognized. And the way not to get people to participate in good public health moves is to tell a huge, we're talking about a huge number of people, right? It's to tell them that they're doing it all wrong and we're going to make you do it. That's going to get people's hackles up. Nobody responds well to that kind of messaging, right? And so, you know, patting conservatives all on the head and saying, oh, you're not so smart, and if you only, you know, knew what we knew, you would do what we say. I think that the reason why we've got this problem is because of how we communicated things in COVID. Now, I understand that doctors were really frustrated. Doctors were very frustrated because they were seeing tremendously sick patients and watching them helplessly die. And that is really, really, you can get PTSD from that, right? And then to have this vaccine come and be the light at the end of the tunnel, like, oh my gosh, this is a miracle. And then have everybody question it. Now, I'm going to say that the original skepticism about the vaccine was definitely coming from the Democrats and the left as well. We've moved too quickly. This is Trump's trying to push stuff on people. All of this stuff there's miles of footage of people raising that question. And then everybody's surprised on the back end when people are like, no, right? So, you know, so unfortunately the vaccine got politicized. And because of the politicization about the vaccine, plus the frustration of doctors, people are like, no, I don't. And that resulted in, I think, the frustration of the doctors resulted in an impatient kind of communication style with people. I think that we should be looking at ourselves and thinking, and I'm not blaming doctors, but we should be looking at what we can do next time. Because now we're in a situation where you've got a perfectly preventable disease that does in fact kill children on a very frequent basis or makes them very, very sick. Nobody wants to listen to us. So we've got to figure out how to get this ship turned around. And the way you don't do that by alienating people.
Yeah.
Because they're just not going to.
Well, you know, she makes a really good point, because there are a lot of conservatives who are, they take weird positions on science, you know, so like during the pandemic, you had all these conservatives saying, stay home unless you want to go to a Black Lives Matter rally. You know, that wasn't scientific. They shouldn't have said that.
No.
And all those conservative governors who were pushing vaccine mandates, well, they exempted their friends.
No, you're talking about, no, those weren't conservatives.
They weren't?
No, that wasn't.
That wasn't the conservatives that did that.
That wasn't the conservatives.
Liza, I'm sorry. I got, mm-hmm. you know, I don't have a PhD, so my head got all scrambled there. No, that was mainstream medicine, mainstream public health, staking out clearly, not just unscientific, but explicitly political positions. And that continues to happen to this day. So, and again, we don't have to get into every single issue. But what other issues related to pediatric health are ongoing in the United States right now that might alarm parents in some of these states? And why might they pass a law that says you have to talk to me before you give my child a medical treatment? What's going
That's
on,
exactly
everybody?
Right.
You know
That's
what I mean?
Exactly right.
Okay. Now, not every public health issue is related. Like, they're not all the same thing. But if you are nature or science or the American Academy, I'm sorry, the Clown Academy of Pediatrics, if you are in this milieu and you don't understand why people are hesitant about letting you make decisions for their kids, you need to wake up.
That's exactly right. And remember, the science should be the pursuit of the truth, right? Regardless of whether or not you're religious, science should be the pursuit of the truth. And if you stick with that, then yes, people were learning about COVID together. We were all in this pandemic together. So we were learning in real time and things had to change. But when people got wedded to ideas that turned out not to be scientifically true and then persisted with those ideas, which had huge, huge economic impacts on people and learning impacts on children. And then you have other, let's say, scientific ideas that may be heavily disputed. People lose a lot of faith in doctors and the medical establishment, and we should be saying the truth and sticking with the truth rather than what is politically expedient.
Yes, it's a very good point. Just to be clear, I'm not saying that the answer to this is that every scientist needs to vote Republican and then push for let's get evolution out of school. That's not what I'm saying, right? The answer, as Liza's getting at very clearly, is our focus needs to be the truth, you know? So if the truth at some point leans a little bit to the right, we need to be okay with that. If it leans a little bit to the left or whatever that means, if it's correct, that's what we're after. That's
right. And silencing dissent, all that does is alienates people. And I'm not saying you have to negotiate with crazy people, but you need, if there's a reasonable scientific question, that should be open for public debate so people can see for themselves that there's an active pursuit of the truth.
Yeah. The other thing to build on the point you made about, you know, things changing during the pandemic, nobody expected everything to be 100% correct all the time, you know, because
right.
I was writing about a lot of these issues and I was following what the other side was saying, if you will, like what were they pissed off about? And nobody said, you know, you keep changing the guidance. Everyone recognized that was going to happen. What irritated everyone, myself included, was that on Tuesday, we wear masks. That's what the science tells us to do. Seriously, in some cases, on Wednesday, the day was, we have good vaccines. You don't need to do it anymore. And then a couple weeks later, it was, oh, just kidding. The vaccines are super great, but we still want you to wear masks because, just in case. So it's like, if you're an average person, you're like, wait a minute, do I get this shot because it works really well? Or do I not get it and wear a mask? Or do I get the shot and I still wear a mask? Or like, I can go to this event, but I can't go to this one. But,
right.
you know, if you want to dress up like the Grim Reaper and go around the beach and lecture people about why they're on the beach, that's fine. But if you want to just sit in the sun with the wind blowing,
yeah,
or you want to go surfing, you know, right, that super congregated activity where everyone's really close together, you know,
right,
you can't do that, right? So this is the insanity that drove people nuts. It's like, it's not the change in guidance. It was that the guidance was this, and if you don't like the guidance, well, maybe we'll fire you or we'll deny you medical treatment. Oh, just kidding. Right. We changed our minds. You know, that's the problem.
That's the problem. That's the problem. I understand that people were scared. And so there's often a knee-jerk draconian reaction. But as it plays out, you can't keep people for 2 years out of school. You have a huge learning deficit that way. And there's still kids that are not back in school. And so I just think that, yes, that people overreacted. They really overreacted. And I'm not saying that the pandemic was terrible and people weren't dying or anything like that. I'm not. But in terms of not listening to the other side, and the an equally credible other side, I'd like to point out, you know, the public saw elite university people from the same elite universities arguing about positions on things, and then one side getting completely shut out of the conversation. And I'm not talking about, and the thing that just also kills me is watching the grifters move in and take advantage of that disagreement. See, look, they're not letting this guy at Stanford or this guy at Harvard participate in this conversation. They're shutting them down. Our stuff's been shut down too. And literally there is somebody who has a clinic that she treats COVID patients with that she charges $1,400 a pop to give them ozone and, you know, hydrogen peroxide. And she's like, and none of them die. And I'm like, well, that's because for most of the people you're treating, they're not going to, right? So except for the treatment you're giving them could harm them, right? But there's so much grifting that's gotten into this. And it was because we weren't willing to have conversations about genuine scientific questions. Ivermectin. I don't believe ivermectin works for COVID, just to clarify. I don't think it works. But there was a legitimate question about whether it worked. And anyone who asked that question was absolutely railroaded. And I think that that's unfortunate, especially because doctors prescribe off-label medicine all the time for things, right? And if an off-label medicine isn't going to necessarily hurt people and has potential to help, fine. I don't particularly care if people prescribe it. That's just happens, right? Ivermectin is a completely benign medicine. Well, not, I mean, every a dose makes a poison, but it's in the realm of things. Hydroxychloroquine, on the other hand, has a narrow therapeutic window. And yes, people thought that would work too. And it had a mechanistic way where they thought it might work. I had no problem with people trying to experiment and things like that. But I don't want people prescribing a whole bunch of hydroxychloroquine because you can get blind from it. You can, I mean, there are real side effects from that medicine. So once again, people absolutely got so wound up about ivermectin that they lost the forest for the trees. And I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah. You know, a lot of that stuff turned out to be correct. You know, the thousandfold risk difference between kids and seniors in terms of risk for severe COVID, the lockdowns being a mistake and having severe consequences. My wife's a public school teacher, and I watched her try to guide a lot of her students through that period where they were stuck at home, and she's trying to teach them about cell division. And they're just like, they're horrified, they're stuck, you know. Not many, but some of them overdosed on fentanyl because they were bored and fearful. So they went out and they got drugs. They're not alive anymore. And some of those students that had learning disabilities, there's a narrow window when they're young where you need to socialize them and you need to help them develop the skills so they can live as normal and functional a life as they can. And a lot of kids were robbed of that opportunity during the pandemic. And they're not dead, but their lives are never going to be what they could have been because they were denied that, you know, and there were people that couldn't bury their family members.
Yep. And you can understand why those people would be absolutely beside themselves with fury and distrusting of any establishment.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, we love vaccines. We love medicine. They're the best. They keep people alive. Yep. We want people to get vaccines when they can have a positive benefit. So this is not a like, you know, we really like RFK. No, we don't.
That guy's awful.
That guy's awful.
Yeah.
He's a clown.
Yes.
A deadly clown, but a clown nonetheless.
Yeah.
Same thing with Alex Jones. So to all our friends in science, you're welcome to come on the show, by the way, and discuss this with us. You know.
Yes, we are open to talking to anybody, and we are open to dissent.
Mm-hmm.
We believe in once again, when you have dissent and discussion about a cordial discussion about dissent,
mm-hmm.
you can find the truth together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, as we wrap up here, that was what our space was all about. As you mentioned a little bit ago, we had a great turnout. I want to say we had like 15 to 20 people show up. Everybody participated. We had a diverse group that had different perspectives, and it was great. It really was beneficial. And so I would love to get those bigger. I'd love to see more people doing them and get more people involved in the discussion. Instead of talking about them in science journals and in your little club, get them involved and engage them. That's the best thing we can
do. Bring them up. That's one of the things about spaces is you can have people, you can have a live, real-time discussion. And so we're going to keep on working on this spaces, and please join us for it so you can come and tell us what you think instead of just listening to us.
Yeah, that's what I loved. And I mean, these episodes are pretty off the cuff. Like, I don't like script out everything I'm going to say,
mm-hmm.
but I have a basic plan of what we're going to talk about. And so does Liza. But on those live conversations, things come up that no one thought of, and it redirects the conversation, and it's fun, you know? That John Stuart
really
Mill
fun.
Guy was onto something, right? It's good to dialogue. This is how you iron sharpens iron and all that kind of stuff. So
that's right.
All right. We'll leave it there, everyone. Thank you for joining us. As always, follow us on X. It's at Dr. Liza MD, at Cam J English. We're going to try to make the space thing a weekly or at least a bi-weekly. Like, we're going to try to do it consistently. So follow us and get involved in that. It's going to be fun. Follow Genetic Literacy Project. They're at Genetic Literacy. We don't speak for them, but they give us this platform. They put out the show on all the platforms for us, and we're grateful for that. So follow them, read their content. And with that, we will see you next week.
See ya.